This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about silence with multi-MOBO award-winning artist Governor B. This is an interview I'm so delighted with. But before we tell you all about that, we'll delve into our theme for a little bit. And specifically, we're going to be talking about silence in relation to speaking up about mental health. There's obviously such a link to stigma and what we campaign against here on Mental. But also something I've been reading up a lot on lately is the silence around mental health struggles within the context of the pandemic. And that's been really interesting because I think there is a general feeling that people are being more open than normal about struggling, and there's a validating experience of people acknowledging that this is an anxious, difficult time and that it's very normal to be struggling with your mental health within this kind of pressured context. But interestingly, there is also a lot of writing about how in some ways, yes, absolutely, there is a lot of conversation, and we've both been very impressed to see that. You know, we did start out the pandemic and the original lockdown wondering, will a lot of mental health concerns be swept under the rug because of the understandable focus on physical health? And for the most part, we've been pleased, but there is also a conversation around a lot of people struggling in silence because they're maybe not going to their GP because they think, oh, they're busy with COVID, or they're, you know, not trying to burden anyone, or they're getting quite socially isolated, they're not seeing people as much, or you're staying silent on your work Zoom call where it goes round the virtual room and says, how's everyone's weekend? And you don't want to be the person that says, oh, I cried all weekend. And so it's interesting reading an article with The Guardian the other day about how silence is still very much there. It's still very much a problem, and it really does hang over a lot of the issues people are facing, even though we're talking about it more than normal.
Absolutely. And it's something I think, Robbie, that people actually don't always think about. I was talking with a client the other day, and it was so evident that this person was really conscious about speaking about their mental health. We weren't actually talking about that specifically, because of the stigma that is now more associated with, oh, really? And now, because the pandemic has, I guess, identified that so many people are struggling with their mental health, that it's almost gone the other way around now. Like, people don't want to talk about it because they feel like it's another person saying, oh, you know, I'm really struggling with my mental health, you know, the pandemic's, you know, I've really struggled since being in the pandemic. Because it's almost like, well, everybody has, so, you know, we're all in this boat, same boat together. And that's just so dismissive.
You know what, I think that's such a good point, because I think that explains a lot of it, that weird irony of, yes, we are talking about it more, but there's still a lot of people that feel excluded from that conversation. That maybe if you're experiencing that feeling that seems very common, and you think you're experiencing a similar level of challenge mentally as everyone else, that can be quite empowering to feel part of the community and we're in it together and other people understand. But if you're struggling more, do you then think, these people aren't coping terribly well, but I'm coping less well? You know, this judgment can still come in the same way. You know, every so often I speak to a friend and they're having a really great day and they feel a bit funny even saying it, because that feels quite incongruent with the times. And so I think that's a big part of it. And the assumption can so often be that our experiences are the same. And so one statistic I found really interesting within that was about students, because our guest today works a lot with students to encourage them to get past silence, speak up when they need help. And I think sometimes we can assume that the age group that Governor B generally works with, you know, younger people, school age or university age, are having more of these conversations and that stigma is removed. But I think it's the same problem of sometimes the conversation is, oh, well, we all get anxious, we all have difficulties at times, that stuff is more normalised. what's the word for it, almost like a layers of stigma we sometimes talk about. And so a stat I've got from the National Union of Students, they found that more than a quarter, so 26% of students who say they experience mental health problems do not get treatment, and only 1 in 10 use counselling services provided by their university. And particularly the second part of that really surprised me. You know, it's so wonderful that universities across the board now have counselling services either embedded in or, you know, really strong links with community services. And yet 1 in 10 students that are struggling with their mental health are taking that up. So there's still a lot of work to do.
There is still a lot of work to do around actively seeking some support and health and what that means, because that stigma really does kick in at that time. And you're right, words are banded around so much more now, like we spoke about it a bit the other week, didn't we, with OCD. But then peers in a lecture, quite a few people are talking about anxiety and, you know, those types of feelings, but nobody's going to get any help, or nobody's saying, oh, I've got an appointment with my counsellor, I'll catch you up after lunch. You know, we would often say, I've got a doctor or dentist appointment without a second thought. So to go and see a counsellor or your therapist, that still isn't a common language in our community. And I just think that's why we're seeing those statistics.
No, that's such a great way of putting it, actually. And it really makes me think about the way I'd phrase that as very much, we need to normalise the getting help. You know, it's one thing to normalise the conditions, the symptoms, I feel like we've normalised more. Then the conditions, then the getting treatment. That seems to be the one that maybe the least progress has been made in. And so it's easy to sometimes stereotype and think, oh, students, they talk about this a lot more, but that doesn't mean the work is done. And this is such a massive challenge at the moment. And like you say, talking about all different conditions is so important. And I feel like even we've been a little bit guilty of that during this pandemic, because so often the easy example to go to is anxiety. You know, the pandemic is fundamentally anxiety inducing as an experience. But one stat I've got from the United Nations reports that in April 2020, levels of depression symptoms were 3 times higher than the previous year. And so I wanted to bring up that stat as an example of one of the conditions that maybe isn't talked about as much as anxiety at the moment. There's so many different ways we can look at how the pandemic is affecting people. We know that rates of drug dependency has gone up massively. We know that the amount people are drinking has been getting unsafe for a lot of people. Depression is one that we are feeling, but maybe not talking about quite as much.
Yeah, absolutely, Bobby. You're absolutely right. Yeah, you're just making me reflect on that, actually. As I'm sat here, seems easier, I guess, to talk about experiencing anxiety across the board, whether it's with a really young person all the way through age groups as opposed to, yeah, depression, really.
I think it's an example of how these conversations always have to have a depth and a reflection to them. You know, it can be very easy to think of the first example and concentrate on that. It can be very easy to talk about whatever comes up on the surface first. And if counselling has taught me anything, it's the stuff that lives beneath, which is generally the stuff we need to tackle the most. That not knowing what's happening, not knowing what to hope for, what our future will be, that can be depressing in itself as a feeling, but also in a mental health way.
There's like a level of empathy that we really want people to experience, that I always talk about people to be able to show and deliver. Like, empathy is huge. But there's that real kind of grey area and that crossover at the moment because of this global pandemic. I'm so bored of saying, there's that whole thing around, well, we're all in it. You know, I've lost my job. You're not the only one. Millions of people have, you know, so validating, you know, or not, your feelings. I think that's something that, yeah, I've thought about much more lately. And this conversation is, you know, fantastic, because no matter what's going on for you, if you're not feeling well, then it's validated. It's valid. Like, don't let what's going on in the world push some of those feelings away and think, well, I would feel like this. Of course I would, because, you know, I've not been able to see my friends for ages. You know, try and recognise when it goes beyond that kind of level. it's really hard to measure, because some of the ways, some of the things that we would use to measure illness, some of the things that we would talk to people about, you know, checking yourself about, they've been taken away from us, you know, withdrawing, isolating, all of the things, sleeping more, not, you know, all of the things that we might have said, you know, as a checklist or a risk assessment that somebody might do if they were talking to somebody that's presenting potentially with depressive symptoms. And I think that then people are struggling, some people are struggling to identify for themselves what really is going on.
Mm, that's so true. And I think in society, we have an overall lack of ability at acknowledging challenges that relate to open-ended things.
Mm.
And I think that's really tricky. And the example that comes to mind for me is grief. We are so much better at dealing with grief when it's just happened. And there's the things you do, like a funeral, like the family coming together and spending time. There's all these things that kick in. But then if you try talking to somebody that's been grieving for years, that's gone by that point.
Mm.
You know, nobody knows what to say at that point. And I include myself, you know, it took me working at Samaritans before I had any idea what to say when someone's grieving and it wasn't recent. And I think we're having maybe a bit of that experience now, that the shock of the pandemic, we were all, you know, on the phone, like, isn't it crazy? What's going on? This is really terrifying. And as it's dragged on, I think a lot of people are struggling to not judge themselves of, okay, well, this is like this for so long now, why am I not coping better? And also struggling at times to connect with others of, hopefully this makes sense in a broad way. I don't quite have the perfect words for it yet, but I think oftentimes we're better at dealing with things that are like finite shocks and all rallying round, but the stuff that drags on, including mental ill health, we can sort of wane and not know what to do long term. So I'm glad that we have a platform like this one where we get to talk long term. And our guest this week is very much an example of that, where we talk about various life stages that he's been through, how that's affected his mental health, including right up to, you know, recent times and how the pandemic has affected him. And he's someone that has experience of both anxiety and depression, like we've talked about. Yeah, just a really fascinating interview and quite a chatty one. We seem to really get on, so that was good.
Oh, I love that. I'm good to that. I missed it. You did it on a Friday. We don't normally record on Fridays, you see. So Bobby recorded this one on a Friday. But again, we're all having to be flexible. We're all Zooming and working from home and doing what we're doing. I know that everything's changing for me, but I am really happy that you got to do it and that you were really pleased with how it went. So I'm excited.
I mean, but it is a funny thing, isn't it? It's like we are flexible and that's good, but also it can be tricky as an expectation, because I've definitely had a lot of experience because so much of my work has been cancelled and podcasting has become, you know, the main structure in my life. A lot of people struggle to connect with, if I'm not interviewing somebody, if I'm not recording, I'm not necessarily free. You know, the rest of life still exists. With that all said, then, we'll get into the episode with Governor B. We hope you enjoy it. And I'll include a link to his new book in the episode description, which, fittingly for the topic, is called Unspoken. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. We're all feeling the strain in some way. For me, it's a lot more time at home with my own thoughts, but with counselling, I don't have to work through them on my own. If you're up for finding a counsellor yourself, BetterHelp is a quick and convenient option. You just need to sign up online to be matched with a fully licensed professional in 48 hours.
From there, you can choose to schedule weekly video or phone sessions in addition to their messaging service to reach out when challenges arise. Plus, with BetterHelp counsellors all over the country, there's a broad range of expertise that may not be available to you locally. And if you don't find the right fit first time, you can switch to a different professional free of charge.
Which I love the way they handle that, because it can be one of the most awkward things if you realise somebody's not the right fit for you. But the BetterHelp team can deal with that conversation on your behalf, and you get in contact via their secure online service to be rematched without having to have the awkward conversation of, I don't know if I'm going to come back to seeing you. And you can join 1 million people who are making the most of these features and taking this brilliant step for their mental health by visiting betterhelp.com/mentalhealth. Plus, they are offering our listeners 10% off their first month just by going to that link, betterhelp.com/mentalhealth, which you can also find in the episode description. So make a change today with BetterHelp.
My name is Isaac Bourquay, more commonly known as Governor B, and I'm a rapper from East London. I was born and raised on a council estate in Custom House. And my parents came over to England from Ghana in their early 20s, and they had me and my younger brother in London. So we're first generation Brits. And I guess the expectation for them was for us to further, you know, the legacy of the family, because they had given up familiarity, family, friends, to come and set up shop over in England for a better life, essentially. So from a young age, I was only allowed to really become a lawyer, a doctor, you know, those kind of occupations. Rapper wasn't really on the list. And so because of that, and because my mind naturally leaned towards more creative fields, I kind of suppressed a lot of what I actually wanted to do in life and kind of hid it from my parents. And in my bedroom, I was writing my lyrics and being creative. But then to their face, I was living up to their expectations. And I guess that maybe started the journey of me being a bit of an internal processor and slightly afraid of confrontation, slightly afraid of being vulnerable. Mm-hmm. I think it all started from trying to, you know, live up to my parents' expectations.
Right. And with that, did you have an idea in your head that one day you would go and fulfill those expectations?
For me, the expectations were non-negotiable. And there was two ways I'd look at it, or two sides to it. So the first side is, it's not actually what I want to do, and I shouldn't really be living up to the expectations, because life is for living and it's my life. As long as I'm respectful, I should go where I'm naturally leaning towards. But then the other side, which is the more complicated side, is I understand that for someone, i.e. my parents, to pack up their bags and move to another country, start a new life, and for them to visualize success as me going into a specific occupation or getting a degree, I feel uncomfortable to disappoint them, you know? Yeah, it was hard. On the one hand, I got it. On the other hand, I was facing this internal battle of just, you know, doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and that's so difficult because, of course, you want to make them happy. But your viewpoints and certainly your experiences growing up would have been so different.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, when my parents, when my dad's passed now, mom's still alive, I think when they look back, they'd realize that they had these ideals that represented success. When they actually experienced me going into my career and packing up the courage to go a different way, they'd say they're really proud of me. And it's just funny how we have these ideals in our heads of what defines success and that kind of stuff. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, it doesn't always matter. Or if it works out differently, we know we'll be okay.
For sure. And they come from a good place. You know, they wanted the best for you. They wanted to protect you and see you have a secure future. And then meanwhile, growing up where you did, can you share a little bit of the influences outside the house?
Yeah, sure. So on the estate, there's a lot of other first generation Brits. There's a lot of, you know, working class English people. And though there were many differences, because we were all different, that kind of brought us together and it kind of united us. When I look out the window of my flat, I would often see, you know, people just hanging around on the streets, young people. And some of the older guys would have, you know, nice cars and the girls, and you see them loitering on street corners and stuff. And as you get older, you realize, okay, they're delving into illegal activity. And my parents are telling me that I need to, you know, focus and do really positive stuff. But also my environment isn't one that is set up to help me thrive. And so I was always too fearful of my parents to get into the nitty gritty and, you know, the real depths of street life. But I was in and around it. I wanted to fit in. I had this desire to be accepted by, you know, every circle or network of friends that I was in. So on the estate, I wanted to appear like I was cool, or if something was going down, like a fight, that I was there to back the fight. I went to school further outside of our area because it was safer, a place called Romford. I wanted to be the funny guy, because in that school, no one was really violent, or there wasn't really any gangsters there. They were just like, all guys that like to laugh. So But every single circle I was in, you know, my parents went to church, so I went to church with them. So I tried to be a good boy in church, bad boy on the streets, funny guy in the school, respectful boy at home. I was just trying my best to fit in. And I think it wasn't until later in life that I realized, I think I'm just different. And maybe I'm born to, you know, stand out and be different. Because it was exhausting, you know.
For sure. And I think that kind of compartmentalization, where you've got a different version of yourself for every environment, it's exhausting, but also it can leave you quite disconnected. Like, which one is the real you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, at 31 years of age, I'm still working out what it means to be authentically me. I had an interesting conversation with my cousin. She's an actress called Michaela Cole. And we had a conversation about code switching.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, how come when you do your interviews on TV and stuff like that, depending on who you speak to, you have a slightly different accent? And, you know, I feel like I do that because I was exposed to a Ghanaian culture inside of my house, and they spoke with a slight Ghanaian twang. On the streets, it was like a lot of East London Cockney talk with, you know, slight gangster mannerisms or whatever you would call it. In Essex, it was very Essex boy. And so I was around so many different people that I was just very impressionable.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing is, I don't feel out of place in different scenarios. So I think with the code switching thing is interesting, because on the one hand, I don't fit in. But on the other hand, I'm entirely comfortable in, you know, different circles. So I don't know what it means to be authentically Governor B. You know, I think I'm still working it out.
And I think with code switching in particular, that's such a difficult line between what is just practical, is you just trying to communicate in a way that's best for the people around you to understand, versus when does that become compromising who you are?
Yeah.
You know, even to a certain extent, I've experienced that where I grew up around a lot of diversity, around a lot of slang and going in and out of that. And then as I've got older, I've lost a lot of it because I'm around different people. I'm doing things like podcasting where you want to be as accessible in your language as possible. And I'm so grateful for certain friends I still have where I can switch back into that and be like, okay, this is a part of my life that I'm still connected to.
Yeah, for sure, man. I think the barometer is if you are, you know, speaking and you recognize that, you know, you're forcing something or you're trying to be something that isn't you. So I think for me, that's only when it becomes an issue, when I think I'm definitely not being me here. And it's funny, I know when I'm not being me, but I don't always know when I am being me.
Yeah, it's strange that. And so we're talking now about a lot of the reflections you've had years on. But if we can go back a little bit to one of the influences I'm interested in is your dad as your kind of role model for masculinity. He sounds like someone that was quite thoughtful, but also quite reserved and quiet.
Yeah, I think, you know, growing up and looking at my dad and him being hardworking, providing for the family, being very reserved, didn't really like rocking the boat, being quite servant-hearted, would do anything for anyone, that kind of stuff. And being very present in the house in terms of physically, I thought that I had, you know, the best dad in the world, purely because on the estate, a lot of my friends didn't have dads. Their dads weren't around, or, you know, they had volatile relationships with their father, which were a bit more blatantly negative. So just for the pure fact that, you know, my dad was around, he was working hard and he was just a good guy to get on with, I thought I was living life. But obviously when you're young, well, for me anyway, I didn't really understand mental health. I don't think my dad did either, or my mum. I don't think that they had equipped themselves with the tools to delve into their emotions or their mental health, because maybe they were so focused on, you know, paying the bills and making rent that month and all that kind of stuff. And so I guess, you know, to answer your question, when I was growing up, I thought my dad was great. I didn't think he had any faults necessarily, but it's not until now that I realized, he never ever said that he had a bad day at work, or he never ever said that he was struggling. It's impossible for a human being to reach 58 years of age and not struggle or not have a bad day. So he must have been hiding a lot, and not maliciously. It's not that he didn't want to communicate that stuff. I think he just didn't know how to. Because I remember times in social settings where, you know, he'd want to say something to add to a conversation or say a joke or something, and he'd kind of start and then he'd stop because he doesn't know how to, you know, communicate it. And he had a bit of a stutter as well, which probably influence that, and, you know, coming to England, it's not really your country and that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's interesting looking back.
Yeah, and that's a lot to navigate that, you know, even a stutter alone can be enough for many people to just give up talking a lot of the time. And the way you've described family life, it sounds like so often it was a focus on survival. And when that's the case, the physical, the stuff that we can see, can so often be prioritized. And so it felt enough that he's physically here. And then it wasn't until later you wonder how emotionally.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess a big part of, you know, what we're discussing is my mum picked up his emotional responsibilities. So I didn't feel like I lacked them. I do think that it would have been important for me to receive that from my dad, but I was getting it from my mum, and she was overcompensating emotionally and always making sure we were all okay and quite talkative and that kind of stuff. So Didn't really feel like I was missing out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's the case. And so often one parent does take up that role, and it is more commonly women in families that do that. And so that's the person you look up to. But then also, you know, naturally as a young guy, you are modeling behavior off your dad. And so do you feel like when it came to your own emotions, you were struggling to find the words, even when he was still around?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, sometimes it's hard to pinpoint why we are the way we are.
Mm.
But when I look at, you know, how I'm probably the slowest communicator, or my wife would describe me as the slowest processor and not the greatest communicator, or in my friendship group, I'm the slowest to come in with a joke and that kind of stuff. I just think that I didn't have the natural tools to communicate well, talk about my emotions and that kind of stuff. And that would be fine if I was given those tools and taught those tools, but I wasn't. And so I think because my dad was the way he was, I just followed suit. It's interesting because you can go both ways. You can be like, right, my dad never did this and I'm never, ever going to be like that, man, because I hated it. Or you can subconsciously slip into everything that's been modeled. And I think that that's what I did. I just subconsciously slotted into what was modeled because it was easy. Also, like, not talking is easy, you know? Not talking is comfortable because you don't have to exert energy, you know?
Yeah.
And you might have the mental battle and struggle of suppression, but ultimately it doesn't really take much effort to not say anything.
And I think that's normalized for all of us. You know, there's such a culture of how are you, I'm fine. People not wanting to burden each other, the stigma around mental health. So often that is the easy route, particularly when you're a young person and you may be struggling with things, you don't have the words anyway. So yes, you probably don't want the questions.
Exactly. I mean, one thing I wonder is my dad was born in this generation where, you know, mental health is spoken about a lot more. I wonder if he'd, you know, be a bit different. Because I'm not even sure he really knew what mental health was or meant or heard that term a lot. You know what I mean? It was super easy for him to be quiet.
We just come to expect that. You know, that was what you knew of your dad. And so How would you see anything different?
One thing that's interesting is he played the disciplinary role quite well. If someone wanted to discipline me and I wasn't listening to her, she would get my dad to do it. And he would always be quite good at explaining why I'm in trouble. Why can't you just behave yourself? Why can't you just... But it's almost, he would only do that if he was forced by my mum. So that kind of showed me that maybe if he did dig deeper, he could communicate and he could talk a bit more, but it's not his default.
Am I right in thinking as well, your mum was the chatty one anyway, so that maybe that silence was filled somewhat by her?
Yeah, for sure, 100%. And yeah, when I look at, you know, some of my friends who are in relationships, very rarely are there two really, really chatty ones. They normally balance each other out. So maybe that's what they slipped into.
I think that happens a lot. And in a way, that might have reinforced certain things. If he didn't feel comfortable talking or not knowing what to say, she was always there to jump in, which can be a blessing, but can also sort of keep you in that point. I think maybe to a degree that happened for you, where you were, you know, growing up, you were having experiences at school where you were relatively staying out of trouble. You've mentioned before a teacher noticing that you were really good at storytelling and so giving you the kind of validation that, oh, actually, you can do okay in this environment. And so do you feel like it then took something really changing for your mental health for that point to come of, okay, I need to speak up?
I think I've been very blessed to have significant people at significant moments in my life steer me in the right direction. my primary school head teacher was the first person to tell me that I was good at something. She told me I was good at writing and I was good at English. And so that was a significant thing that steered me. My youth leader at the youth club was another guy that said, oh, you're really good at rapping. You should rap about positive things. That was another person that steered me in like a good direction. So yeah, I guess to answer your question, I don't know if my life has been too intentional with how it's panned out. But I think that whenever there's a significant person that encourages me and causes me to aspire to something, another barrier of communication opens up because I'm excited and I see a future and I'm like, I want to share this. I want to talk more with someone. But before that, you know, I was just counting the days because my life's a bit boring and yeah, I'm struggling mentally. Friend of mine got murdered on the estate and all that kind of stuff. But it's just life, innit? And life goes on and I didn't want to talk about it. But yeah, I think significant people made me speak more.
Yeah, and it's interesting actually when certain things aren't talked about, how that can be so normalizing. Yeah, you just think, oh, well, this is life. This must be it.
Exactly. I mean, the funny thing about that is at the time when it happened, we were all obviously very shocked and down. But in front of, you know, my friends, we didn't really say that to each other. We kind of sensationalized, glamorized it. And was like, man, that's crazy that happened. But no one would cry. And the next day, life just seemed to go on. But that night, when we talk about it now, you know, 15 years on or whatever it is, every single one of my friends said, oh, I didn't sleep that night. Or I cried that night in my bedroom. But it's like, in the moment, not talking about it and suppressing it is so normal.
Am I right in thinking that's something that happened then when you lost your dad, where you're feeling a level of grief you didn't really know existed? Because that's so often something we don't talk about. Of course, you start thinking, no one can relate to this. No one can be experiencing this because I never hear anyone talk about experiencing this.
Yeah, precisely that. I think that's the reason why my initial reaction was to internalize my grief. You know, everyone around me was encouraging me to talk, are you okay, and that kind of stuff. And I was just like, yep, yeah, I'm fine, I'm doing good. But it hit boiling point when I reached mental capacity and I broke down about 3 months later because my dad was the closest person that I've ever met. Every single day I woke up, it's just a reminder that he's not here. He's not on the phone. He's not driving me to the airport. He's not texting me to fix his iPhone for him, all those kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I broke down in floods of tears on a beach in California. And the craziest thing about that is after I had cried, I felt a freedom that I hadn't felt for a long, long time. And that was, you know, the big thing, the big wow moment, the light switch that made me think, maybe the way I've been dealing with grief in the past or trauma in the past isn't healthy. Because I've cried, which is apparently weak, but I feel free, which is weird.
And when you've gone so long having those set ways of thinking that are so normalized, this idea of boys don't cry, and then to realize, oh, no, this can be a good thing. This can be a release of emotion. There are other ways of dealing with this. Yeah, I can see how much of a release that must have been.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. There are other ways of dealing with it. Sometimes it's good to be strong. Sometimes it's good to not cry. Sometimes it's good to cry. You know, one thing I learned is that the whole like not crying and strength and dominance thing is often pushed to us as, it's like, this is the bravest thing you can do as a man. This is, you know, the strongest thing you can do as a man. But I didn't actually find it that brave, like, to be strong. Like, it was quite easy because you know that society and friends and family are going to reward you for doing this. Oh, you're so strong. Your dad passed away. Look at you doing the funeral and stuff, carrying the coffin, looking after the family. That's such a strong thing to do. Well done. It's a natural reaction of conditioning. But the bravest thing is crying. Like, the bravest thing is showing your weakness. And so that paradigm shift between what I, you know, perceived as brave and strong and vulnerable and weak, it just changed. Because I actually think, you know, crying is a really strong and brave thing to do. So it changed the way I perceived those things.
That's massive, because I agree, when you're stepping out of norms in a way like that, it is brave. That takes so much more than maybe going along with how things have been, particularly so often when we look at, like you say, certain things that can be stereotyped as brave. You know, we see portrayals in our media of violence, for example, and we're encouraged to think that's brave. And then when it happens in the real world, we're told that it's not. And there's that weird contrast. And I think for me, something you've talked about in the past, which is knife crime, you've talked about how so much of that comes from fear. And I think that's part of the explanation. You know, the brave thing is going against what might feel like the route to less fear that everyone else is going along, you know. And I think that's where a lot of the misunderstanding comes from. If you've not been in an environment where you feel terrified to not carry a knife, you think, if I don't do this that everyone else is doing, they're all doing it and I'm not, then something's going to happen to me.
Yeah, exactly what you said. In my experience, and I guess, you know, writing this book and talking about these issues, one thing that's really hard is to not generalize or stereotype. So that's one thing I'm always very careful of doing. But my experience, no matter who you are, you know, I've spoken to kingpins, like top of the drug trade, all that kind of stuff, right down to just your average good guy trying to do positive stuff. One thing we all have in common is we all want safety. We're all looking for that safe place to be truly who we are, to be vulnerable, to feel all the things. And if we don't find safety, if we don't have that safe place, we have fear. And fear can show itself in different forms, you know. Fear can be carrying a knife. Fear can be isolating yourself. Fear can be, you know, putting up a brave face and all that kind of stuff. But for me, I don't know what dictionary.com would tell you, but the opposite of fear is safety, I think, and having that safe space.
Not having that can warp your experience so much. That's kind of across the board. If you're feeling unsafe in your mental health, if there's turbulence there, you can do plenty of things that don't make sense with people.
Yeah, for sure. One thing I talk about a lot and share about is a couple of years back being in Ghana on a beach and just along the coast seeing a fisherman put a load of crabs into a bucket. And every time one of the crabs would climb to the top of the bucket, another one would put it down. And something that my mum used to say to me when I was younger, I would say, that crab's in a bucket. Like, you know, when young men on the estate are just pulling each other down. But everyone just focuses on the crabs, you know, as the problem. And we don't really focus on the bucket, which is our environment. If we live in an environment that causes us to thrive mentally, you know, emotionally, physically, financially, all the alleys that you need in life, then people tend to make better decisions, you know?
I love that way of phrasing it, actually, the crabs in the bucket. And I think that really speaks to how influential our environment is. You know, I've had conversations with people where they just cannot relate to the route some people take because they've just come from such a different background. And, you know, I've had to even go as far in the past as saying, well, you know, what position do you think you'd be if you were terrified of the guy that lives around the corner more than the police?
100%. And the crazy thing as well is that I think when we talk about a negative environment, we can just think working class or, you know, council estate culture, whatever it is. But I've done workshops in schools in underprivileged area. And yeah, that is the environment we're talking about. A negative one, like crime infused, lots of stuff happening. But I've also done sessions at private schools where some of the kids are addicted to taking drugs. And that environment is daddy's a super wealthy businessman, never ever at home. Parents leave me with this child mind that I just don't care about. I'm super bored. We've got all this money, but nothing to do. So when I talk about, you know, mental health and our environment, I don't think it's something that's unique to class or race or income and that kind of stuff. I think a healthy environment can look different in different contexts, you know?
Oh, for sure. Because actually, I say all the time, there's far more that unites us than divides us. The pressures, a lot of them, whilst the situation and the specifics may be different, you know, that child in a private school, even if they don't have certain concerns, you know, every parent wants the best for their kid. There's a lot of this that's universal in the same way mental health, you know, that can have highs and lows for all of us. There is no financial insulation that can protect you.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's really clever to come off the back of it, but I just agree with everything.
Well, thank you. Well, one thing I want to get to talking to actually is one of the things that helped you in moving past silence, and that was counselling, right?
Yeah, so there was a lot of stigma attached to it for various reasons. I think just being, you know, young black guy, council estate, none of us go counselling. No one on the estate went counselling. It's like, why are you going to tell a random person your deepest, darkest? And also, I guess, culturally, in Ghanaian culture, if you go to seek help from someone outside of the family, it's quite embarrassing to the family because it shows that you can't keep the family in order, even though there's a very good reason for you to seek help. So, you know, my parents probably would have been against it. And also my parents were Christians as well. And there's this kind of warped view that if you have God, then you don't need anything else. Whereas I think, actually, you know, you can have a belief system, but also use professional human help to aid your mental health. So, yeah, I was against it.
I just want to pause on that, actually, also coming from an Irish Christian background. That's something that really concerns me. There can be such a pressure to only find the answers in religion. And I think that's where a lot of the danger is. You can have multiple routes and it's not a threat to your religion if you go get support from a person. And in fact, one thing that is really nice to see is that more and more we're seeing that being embraced. You know, like one of the big churches here in central Birmingham on Cars Lane, which it's named after, they have their own in-house counseling service. And so when even the religious bodies themselves are recognizing people need all kinds of support, that that's really important to me.
For sure, man. And it's nice to see it be embraced. I mean, the way I look at it is, can't tell me, you know, your God's this big all powerful thing that, you know, can answer every question. And if we have a doubt about our mental health or need help, what's it going to hurt his pride if he goes to see a counselor? Not him. I'm sure that's why he didn't put us on this earth alone. That's why we have each other, you know. I don't think anyone's meant to go through life alone.
I think that's it. You know, we should be supporting each other. It's why we have the communities, the families that we do, you know, looking after each other. To me, that's always been part of my religious background.
Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, thankfully, my wife thinks the same. And she was the one that really pushed me to go counselling. If I was a kid, I'd probably have gone kicking and screaming. But I reluctantly went. And yeah, I think I was blessed because I actually quite liked our counsellor. We went together. So she was kind of like a marriage counsellor. And the reason we went is because I had started drinking alcohol a lot more, kind of to numb the pain of my dad passing and to just numb my thoughts in a way and be able to sleep and stuff. And so it was affecting my marriage, and that's why we went. But yeah, in counselling, it's crazy. I shared some stuff that I'd never ever shared before in my life. Yeah, I walked out feeling lighter, and so just kept going back. And I'm grateful that I went, and I've, you know, had to go by myself, and I have as well. And I've seen, you know, a couple counsellors that I didn't really connect with. So I always say to people, don't worry if you go and it's like the worst experience ever. Try your best, you know, keep trying and hopefully you connect with someone.
It's great to hear that you had that experience, and we'll start wrapping up soon. But the last thing I want to talk to you about is kind of this idea of breaking the mold through generations. So you were in that situation where you'd lost your dad. You'd lost somebody who, although he was quiet, he was always there. And it sounds like he was a very consistent and reassuring presence in your life. And then you're in a position where, in struggling to cope with that, you're also finding yourself very closed off. And your wife is struggling to connect with you, knowing what's going on. She's worried of aggravating you. It almost sounds like in the way you write it, because she just didn't know what you were going to react to and how to reach you. And in that sense, you were kind of becoming possibly like your dad. You were becoming the silent one in the household. And counselling and other support was a way to get out of that. So can you share a little bit about that experience and also what you hope to pass on to help break that chain for your son?
Yeah, sure. So it was actually in a counselling session where the penny dropped and I realised that I was basically my dad, where some of the patterns that Emma was expressing, I realised that, yeah, I saw those in my dad, and it made me realise that we actually pick up what we see around us. You know, we're conditioned by everything we see, consciously or subconsciously. And so for my son now, who's a year and a half, I'm just always aware that he's picking up everything. Even, you know, every morning, get him out of his cot, take him downstairs, put him on a sofa, stick the telly on for a little bit of TV. He expects that when he wakes up. He knows that's the routine. Or he sees me brushing my teeth. He starts mimicking me now. He's brushing his teeth with a toothbrush. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Every single time something like that happens, it's a reminder that he's watching me, even when I'm just in myself and just being me. And so I put this on the first page of the book, with every generation, there's as much to learn as there is to teach. And so as much as I'm teaching my son stuff, I need to realize that he's also, you know, learning from me, and I need to be learning as well. So I'm the best that I can be. I'd love to, in 100, 200, 300 years or whatever it is, I'd love for us to be able to look down, you know, the legacy generation by generation and say, okay, they don't just look healthier, you know, but they actually are emotionally healthy and they're looking after their mental health. And every generation is taking this more and more seriously, you know. And with mental health, I don't actually see it as a destination. Like, it's not like, oh, yeah, now my mental health is like 10 out of 10. I'm set for life. I think it's a journey, you know. It's a constant battle, constant reminder. It's constantly, right, am I making decisions to be as healthy as I can today? And you might get that right sometimes. Other days you might be not so good, but I'm tired of beating myself up about it and trying to get to this destination of perfect mental health. Because some days I might get near, other days I might backtrack. But I think as long as I'm aware of it, then I'm ready for the fight and ready to journey with it.
Absolutely. That's massive. And so often getting through it in the past just gives us that resilience. It can almost become like a muscle memory, that a certain amount of working on your mental health and parts of it get automated almost. And with that in mind, with the time we're in now, you know, so much of your life is restricted. You're not out able to tour like you normally would. You're not able to connect with your fans in the same way. Have you found that elements of depression or other difficulties you've experienced have come up again?
Yeah, definitely. I don't always know what they look like or how to differentiate depression from anxiety, from claustrophobia. But I think with the pandemic, all of these things of like restricted, not seeing people, having to be in your house a lot more than you are, they result in feelings of anxiety and feelings of depression. And those are definitely things that I've faced. A major thing for me in combating that is, number one, perspective. And, you know, my son has been amazing because he's kind of the very visual silver lining that I have, that he's just doing his thing. It's great to have that. But if I didn't, I'd love to challenge myself to look for a blessing in my life that I could focus on, that could put me in more of a positive mindset. Because the reality is, it's crap. Like, we can look at stuff like and just name it. That's crap, that's crap, that's crap. But I think, yeah, trying to find perspective is a big one. And secondly, deeper connectivity. You know, I'm so lazy with social media, my phone, being able to see people, going out to dinner, having food. But now I think, okay, rather than asking, how are you? Like you mentioned before, yo, mate, on a scale of 1 to 10, how are you feeling today? Give people the opportunity and create space for them to, oh, I'm a 5 today. Why are you a 5, man? Oh, because this is going great, but this is going not so great. And then, you know, you encourage deeper connection.
There's a lot we can learn from that, and also the levels people are living at. You know, a lot of people might be never above a 5, and that's their normal. And so sometimes it takes something as simple as a friend, you know, really taking the time to find out how you are can sort of spark that of, oh, no, there could be more than surviving this, than just getting through day by day.
Yeah, I heard this one thing the other day that I think summed it up. And it was like, we're all in the same storm, but not everyone's in the same boat. And that made me realize that, yeah, like everyone's going through what's happening now. But there's some that are managing better than others, some in slightly different scenarios and stuff. And we just got to bear that in mind.
It's very true. And so if people have been connecting with your experience, your particular boat, could you tell us a bit about your book, Unspoken, and where people can find it?
Yeah, sure. So the book's called Unspoken, Toxic Masculinity and How I Faced the Man Within the Man. And it's all about, you know, how I was conditioned that, you know, a real man doesn't cry and is always strong and is always dominant. But, you know, after my dad passed away, my mind and my body was telling me, actually, you need to cry and you need to be vulnerable. But I was still living up to those ideals, which became very harmful for me and resulted in a breakdown. And so it's me kind of smashing those ideals down and looking at what it takes to be a man. And essentially, it's a complex question, but we shouldn't be afraid of being vulnerable and honest. And yeah, I just wrote about my experience.
Brilliant. And yeah, I definitely recommend it. I will put some links in the episode description if people want to go check that out, because it came out just, I guess it'll be last month by the time this comes out, but only recently.
Yeah, pretty new. So check it out.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining me. Is there any kind of final message you would want to share if people are having a lot of challenges dealing with lockdown 3 at the moment? Any final thoughts?
Yeah, man. I'd say number one, try and be kind to yourself, you know, in whatever scenario you are. Be super kind to yourself. You're doing the best you can. And oftentimes that's all we can do. And I'd say secondly, if you can pluck up the courage and and you have the tools to do so, look after the puddles before they turn into floods. Because when we suppress stuff and we don't look after, you know, things or we recognize them, you think we're dealing with it by keeping it in. But, you know, for me anyway, 5 years, 10 years later, I'm spilling my guts out in counseling and it's a much bigger thing than I thought it was in the first place. So, yeah, deal with those puddles as they come.
I love that. I also love that you're just obviously such a writer that you've got all these things just locked in, all these quotes.
I can't help it, man. I think in rhyme and analogies and stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's one of those things, right, that sometimes the time we spend in silence, actually, we can get a lot from, in the same way the times we struggle with our mental health can teach us how to cope better. There's so much that we can get from this. And hopefully that's part of the pandemic. We'll learn a lot from this time as well.
100%. Couldn't have said it any better. I don't think any of those things are bad. Silence, strength, not crying and that kind of stuff. But I think it's just being aware of how we feel and feeling all the things, not just some of the things, you know?
Yeah, not just the socially acceptable emotions. And yeah. I like that way of looking at it. They're not bad, but there are so many better things. Better ways to cope. All right.
100%.
So we'll wrap up there. Thanks again.
All good, man.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.